A 900-page report details systemic failures leading to a highly publicized prison escape in North Arkansas. The Arkansas State Archives celebrates the state's musical heritage in its annual fall symposium, and planners and public officials come together to find solutions to Northwest Arkansas's housing crisis. Those stories and more are coming up this week on the News Wrap from the Arkansas Newsroom. I'm Daniel Breen, News Director of Little Rock Public Radio. Each week, we're recapping the top stories from all across the Natural State. We'll unpack the headlines, share exclusive insights, and provide the context you need to fully grasp the issues that matter most to Arkansans. That's this week on the Arkansas News Wrap, coming up right after the news from NPR. This is the Arkansas News Wrap. I'm Daniel Breen with Little Rock Public Radio. A new investigation reveals top-down failures behind a recent prison escape. The Arkansas State Police published a 900-page report documenting a chain of failures that let a convicted murderer slip out. Little Rock Public Radio's Josie Lenora is here to recap this investigation. Hey, Josie.
Hi, Daniel.
So we are talking about the escape of Grant Hardin. He was an inmate at the North Central Unit State Prison in Calico Rock in northern Arkansas. Hardin escaped last May of this year, and it was very widely publicized when it happened. The search took about 12 days, right?
Yeah, and reading the report, it's surprising how easy it was for him to basically just walk out of the prison. It's like the trope in James Bond movies where someone leaves the captive alone and is terribly surprised that they escaped.
Yeah, so the investigation is pretty comprehensive. Over 100 inmates and 80 staff members were interviewed, including Hardin, who was interviewed 5 times. Arkansas State Police Senior Special Agent Mike McNeil put the report together. What were your takeaways from reading all of this?
There's a lot of contradictions among witness testimony in the reports, a lot of blame, a lot of repeated mistakes, and it's unclear if the problems causing the escape have been fixed.
So to back up a bit, Hardin was in prison for some pretty serious felonies.
Before he was arrested, Hardin was the police chief of Gateway, and this is a small town in the northwest corner of the state along the Missouri border. There is an HBO documentary about him released before he escaped prison called Devil in the Ozarks.
This is the story of one of the most evil and dangerous criminals I have ever prosecuted.
Hardin was the kind of person true crime documentaries get made about. His life was riddled with bizarre and horrible behavior. Hardin's own family described his police leadership as frightening and riddled with abuse of power accusations. He apparently liked to drive around the road erratically to intimidate citizens. And it was the city council that forced him out of the role. About 9 months later, he shot and killed a municipal water employee he allegedly disliked. When you get arrested in Arkansas, they run your DNA through a database, and they got a match on him. His DNA was the same as fluids recovered from an unsolved rape in 1997.
And Hardin pleaded guilty to both of those crimes and got an 80-year sentence. Considering his age, it's pretty unlikely he would have ever left prison, so he escaped.
This brings us to the first big failure documented in this investigation. Hardin's crimes should have put him in a maximum security prison from the get-go. For some reason, the prison software only tabulated his murder charge, not the additional rape conviction, so he was sent to the medium security prison in Calico Rock. Prison higher-ups have avoided copping to any classification mistakes. It should have been strange that Hardin was one of the most violent offenders at the prison. At a legislative meeting in July, there seemed to be this real inability for Board of Corrections members and prison officials to just say, sorry, we mixed it up. Warden Thomas Hirsch said this at a legislative meeting.
This inmate never had the first disciplinary infraction until this. He had been, and I'm not going to say a role model inmate because I don't want to use that term, but he had been an inmate that had followed the rules.
The investigation says Hardin spent 6 months planning to escape the North Central Unit. Hardin had a prison job in the kitchen. This is the second big breakdown. The kitchen seems insecure and ill-run. Hardin made an escape costume by collecting black Sharpies, quote, lying around the kitchen. He started scribbling black ink into his clothes. He used aprons to make a fake employee vest. Hardin says he noticed that a trash can in the prison kitchen was never shaken down or inspected. Though the 4 staff supervisors of the kitchen were responsible for regular checks, Hardin put his contraband under the trash bag in the bin, something only discovered the day after he escaped.
And so he slipped out because he was left unsupervised on the back dock of the kitchen. Was that in and of itself against prison rules?
I'm not sure, and the investigation isn't quite sure either. The documents show a game of telephone over whether inmates are allowed to work in that area unsupervised. The warden says it's against the rules. 2 weeks before the escape, they had a staff meeting. The warden said he made some employees sign something prohibiting prisoners from being alone in that area. But the report from the meeting doesn't say anything about this. It just says the back door had to be locked. And each witness seems to have a different takeaway from this meeting. One food production supervisor remembered being told that some prisoners could be left alone on the back dock. Another kitchen staffer says she was told the opposite. Quote, inmates were not to be left unsupervised on the back dock under any circumstances.
And a lot of the blame for this incident, at least in the report, has gone to Sergeant Hayden Grady. He was the food production manager on the day of the escape. And do I have this right? He spent most of the day on his phone.
When asked by the investigator why he was on the phone, the report says Grady was talking to his girlfriend, quote, almost every hour. Grady was cagey during his investigative interview. At one point, he refused to answer questions because, and I'm quoting, I don't want to say anything that would get me in trouble.
But it was another employee who left Hardin alone, not Grady.
Yes, kitchen supervisor Justin DeVale, who did not believe it was a rule violation, made the choice to release Hardin to clean an outdoor cage, leaving him alone for about an hour. This is when the actual escape begins. Imagine a timeline. It's 2:10 p.m., May 25th, Sunday. Hardin's been left alone out back. The dock is both a blind spot in the cameras and a place prisoners are left unsupervised. He takes a few minutes to put on his fake prison guard uniform he made with kitchen items. He also collected wood pallets and put them on a dolly. The pallets were supposed to be used as a ladder to climb over the gates, but he never needed them. All this preparation took about 30 minutes. Again, he was standing outside putting on an escape costume in a prison.
And the disguise kind of worked.
It really did. Okay, now it's 2:53 p.m., and to get out of the prison, Hardin had to slide out of the two gates that flanked the perimeter. All Hardin had to do was yell gate, and he was buzzed through by an officer. That officer was William Walker. From on high, Walker thought Hardin was a prison official. So this is the third big, large failure the report's document. Opening the gate is supposed to be a multi-step process with visual identification. Walker just trusted that the man was a staff member.
And was he interviewed in the investigation?
In the report, Walker seems very upset with himself. I'm quoting, he says, I was not paying attention. And he also says he was looking towards the back part of the prison, watching it rain. In the minutes after Walker buzzed Hardin through, Walker started to feel uneasy. Hardin left behind his car with a makeshift ladder. He hadn't gotten in a car, and he seemed to kind of disappear into the woods. When Walker started talking to other prison workers, he realized he may have made a terrible mistake. Meanwhile, DeVale, the kitchen worker, went out to the back dock to get Hardin for dinner. It's 3:08 p.m. now. No one knows where Hardin is. Guards at the North Central Unit do an emergency count of every prisoner, and everyone was accounted for except for Hardin.
Okay, so Hardin is out of prison, but they don't find him for another 12 days. At this point in the timeline we're talking about, the hunt was just about to begin. Can you talk about that?
In his first few minutes of freedom, Hardin crossed the road around the facility. He followed a small trail into the woods. The woods near the prison are quite dense. By 5:30 p.m., the state and local police had arrived, and they were pulling out all the stops to find Hardin. They put drones in the sky and searchers on the ground. They roamed the land for Hardin using a canine named Gracie. They tried using a helicopter to find Hardin, but the rain canceled this plan.
And Hardin didn't get very far. They caught him like 1.5 miles away from the prison. What was his life like on the run?
The first night, Hardin says he didn't move. He isolated somewhere in the woods. He started to move around a little more the second night, but he was separated from his food. Instead, he says he ate off the land, scavenging the wild, eating, quote, berries, bird eggs, and ants. Because he had a CPAP machine at the prison, Hardin had been given special distilled water. So he hydrated for 12 days using both distilled water and swigs from the creek. Hardin says his escape plan was to stay hidden in the woods for, quote, 6 months if need be.
And this search was obviously a major event. Police didn't stop looking even in the early hours of each morning, right?
They seemed to be slowly closing in on him. He was able to hide because of the rain and because of all the vegetation around the prison. But what ultimately did him in is that he got hungry. A Border Patrol agent found him when he was on the move at 3:28 p.m. June 6th.
So now Hardin is in a more secure prison, like he was supposed to be all along.
The day he was caught, Hardin was moved to the Varner Unit, a supermax prison in Gould, Arkansas. There's much tighter and more oppressive security there. Now he's facing even more charges for felony escape, so it's virtually impossible he leaves prison again in his lifetime.
And there was another legislative hearing on Tuesday of this week about the escape. What was discussed in that?
Most lawmakers didn't have time to read the full report. They had received it about a day beforehand. Lawmakers from both parties were skeptical that the Department of Corrections had fixed the problems leading to the escape. But I anticipate they're going to have more meetings, and they said they were going to have more meetings once they read the report. And I'll follow up with listeners when that happens.
All right, perfect. Well, that was Little Rock Public Radio's Josie Lenora talking about a massive investigation into the recent high-profile prison escape in northern Arkansas. Thank you, Josie, for your reporting.
Thanks, Daniel.
As the housing crisis continues in northwest Arkansas, groups are coming together to find potential solutions. Groundwork, an offshoot of the Northwest Arkansas Council, is hosting an annual housing summit, bringing together public and private leaders to learn from industry experts and collaborate on solutions across city lines. Groundwork's communications director, Isabella Gamora, spoke with KUYF's Matthew Moore.
I think it's interesting to think about how, when we think about Northwest Arkansas, we often refer to it regionally as Northwest Arkansas, not to specific cities, because as you mentioned, the way that we think about housing is different from, say, a singular city with suburbs, right? That like having someone come in who's done city planning in Chicago or Nashville even may have some worthwhile things, but thinking on it on a more regional level is probably more effective for our community. And I'm sure that plays a role in who you decide to bring in for these sorts of events.
Yeah, absolutely. So, you know, I think we are both blessed, and it's kind of a challenge in the sense that we are a polycentric region with more than 20 municipalities of different varying sizes, which makes it more difficult to implement, you know, brash change because you have to work within each of the municipalities. So bringing in TED is a great example of how we can work together as municipalities to help address these issues from infrastructure to housing. So we're really happy to have him, and he can talk about what that process was for them and how we can look to their region, which is very similar to our region probably 15 years ago, and how we can take some of their learnings, good or bad, and implement them here.
I also think a lot about how we have the larger cities in our region, but we also have places like Centerton, Pea Ridge, these communities kind of on the outskirts of the larger towns that are quickly and rapidly growing. We're seeing huge population booms in some of these smaller towns nearby. And I have to think that being on the ground as you guys are here can be beneficial at this point in time, because we're really at an inflection point when it comes to some of these smaller towns growing and growing quickly, and making sure the infrastructure is in place to make sure that we can grow sustainably as well.
Agreed. I think, you know, a lot of these towns are grappling with that idea of how do they maintain their core identity as they continue to grow. So as this regional plan is in place, I think a lot of the support that we'll be providing those smaller towns is ways that they can continue to be Centerton and Pea Ridge as they were, and then really grapple with the idea of what they want to become as they grow, and really implementing best practices to sustain the green areas and really make sure they're growing in a sustainable and economically fiscal manner.
The last part of your summit here is an optional part, but is a tour of Biggs. Emma, why is that an important element of this summit for y'all?
Yeah, sure. So Big Emma is Groundwork's first investment that we made. It was meant to be kind of a project that shows how public-private partnerships can help build affordability into developments. So for those who don't know about Big Emma, it is a new building that is almost at completion on Big Emma, on Emma Avenue in Springdale. It's 70 units, and 30 of those units are going to be reserved for lower income. So they will be about 30% less than what market rate would be. And the way that we worked that out is we did an investment, but we also worked with the builder and a nonprofit developer, which is Community Development Northwest Arkansas, to bring this building to light. And it's really just a demonstration on how we can use innovative ideas to begin to bring some, to infuse some affordability into our developments.
As you talked about the element, what was the word you used? Polycentric, yeah. This polycentric kind of model that we have here in Northwest Arkansas of working with multiple municipalities in order to get the sort of work done. It's a challenge, certainly. It's probably more bureaucratic, but do you hope that it can also be more productive? Because what's happening in Springdale here with Big Emma, for example, can be easily replicated in other municipalities?
Yeah, absolutely. So I think that, you know, while it may be more difficult in terms of having to work with every single city, I think our polycentric nature is something that makes us unique and really is a value to our region. You know, each of our cities kind of has their own unique identity, which I think really helps bring different perspectives into our region. And, you know, we've already seen some cities implement things and then other cities replicate or learn from what cities have done. And so, yeah, definitely whatever we do in one city can serve as a learning experience for other cities. And as they work together to figure out how they can work together better, I think these types of examples will show what cities can do to really bring more housing into their municipality.
That was Isabel Gamara, Communications Director at Groundwork, speaking with KUAF's Matthew Moore. The Arkansas State Archives is hosting its annual Fall Symposium at the Mosaic Templars Cultural Center in Little Rock this Saturday. This year's theme is Tales and Tunes, a celebration of Arkansas music. KASU's Marty Scarborough spoke with Brian Irby, archival assistant at the archives, about the event.
Well, first of all, for people who may not be familiar with them or know what the purpose and mission of the Arkansas State Archives is, could you tell us a little bit about that?
The Arkansas State Archives is one of the oldest agencies in state government. We've been around since 1905, and since then, we've been collecting things related to Arkansas history, and this includes letters from just average people, average Arkansans throughout the years, and on up to governor's papers. We have a lot of governor's papers in our collection, as well as probably our prized possessions that we have are our Arkansas constitutions. We have all the original constitutions from Arkansas. There's been five of them over the years. We have them all. They're all the handwritten ones that were drafted, that the constitutions were ratified. So those are our big treasures that we have in our collection.
So you've got the theme, Tales and Tunes, a celebration of Arkansas music. Well, first of all, how does this theme fit into the mission of the Arkansas State Archives?
We consider music a part of Arkansas history as well. I mean, it's, music is such a big part of the human condition, going all the way back. Some of the earliest archaeological evidence we have of human beings they find stone flutes and things like that. So it's been something that's just a part of our DNA. And because of that, it's just kind of, you see music woven throughout all of human history and Arkansas history in particular. Arkansas has a unique place in the country in that we have such a wide variety of different kind of musics that have been kind of developed here. A lot of people think of the Mississippi Delta as being just Mississippi, but you have to include Arkansas as well. I mean, a lot of the Delta blues that developed in the early part of the 20th century was not just in Mississippi. I mean, they traveled through Arkansas, traveling throughout Eastern Arkansas. You know, Robert Johnson visited Helena several times and played. It was part of his regular circuit. And up north, you have the music that came with the Ozark culture, a lot of kind of folk tales, folk songs that came from the British Isles came over and kind of developed here in northern Arkansas. And we're proud of that heritage as well. And, you know, there's just been so many different types of music that have kind of developed here. And we're just excited to get to share that with everyone.
Well, it seems to me, I've noticed that just even over the last 6 months, there are more and more groups and organizations that are working to promote Arkansas's musical legacy. Why do you think at this point in our state's history and culture, there's a greater emphasis on the music that's emerged from our state?
When a lot of people think of Arkansas music, they think of Johnny Cash and things like that. I mean, kind of the big names. And I think people are starting to kind of discover a lot of the music that maybe has been neglected over the years. And I think that's maybe part of it. I can't really explain why there's been such a gravitation towards it, but other than it's good music, you know.
Now, with this being a symposium, you're going to have multiple guest speakers. We can't go into deep detail about everything that will be discussed over that 6-hour-long symposium, but can you give us just briefly some highlights and talk to us about some of the specific topics that will be discussed this year?
Yeah, so we tried to kind of run the gamut of different types of music. So we've got someone's going to talk about the unknown story of the origins of the Grand Ole Opry in Arkansas. A lot of people think it's just Tennessee thing that has dug into the story, and he's discovered some clear Arkansas roots. We've got one of the big things for music in Arkansas has always been the Ozark Folk Center. We've got someone who's going to come down and talk about some of the archival recordings that have been made up there. We've got someone going to talk about some of the big names that are maybe not household names, but they're names that were very important to development of music, popular music in Arkansas and across the country. We've got Stephen Cook is going to talk about the life and legacy of Louis Jordan, who is, you know, such a big name in the development of early rock and roll music, as well as we have someone is going to come talk about the life and legacy of Sister Rosetta Tharpe, who was also a big part of the development of early rock and roll. We've tried to run the gamut of different types of music. We've got a lot of live music that's going to be there. It's not just going to be just people talking all day, which has got me pretty excited. Stephen Cook is going to play some of Louis Jordan's songs. We've got a group called the Creeks Rocks from Missouri. They're going to come down and they're going to play some archival recordings of some Ozark singers, folk singers, and they're going to perform their own renditions of those songs. And I think that's a really cool way to kind of look at those kinds of music. We've got the St. Mark's Baptist Choir here from Little Rock is going to come out, and they're going to sing some gospel songs and to show how the legacy of Sister Rosetta has continued throughout the years.
That was Brian Irby, archival assistant at the Arkansas State Archives, speaking with KASU's Marty Scarborough. The State Archives Fall Symposium, titled Tales and Tunes, a Celebration of Arkansas Music, is set for this Saturday at the Mosaic Templars Cultural Center in downtown Little Rock. And that's it for this week. The Arkansas News Wrap is brought to you by the Arkansas Newsroom, a collaboration between KUAF in Fayetteville, KASU in Jonesboro, and Little Rock Public Radio. You can find this week's episode on any of our station's websites. Until next time, I'm Daniel Breen, and this is the Arkansas News Wrap.